Hello and welcome to this is a new kind of a branch of a podcast. This is time. This is Conversations on the Timeline. Got to get name right. Conversations on the Timeline with me, T.L. Foster, and I am joined today by somebody who I've been trying to podcast with. It seems like 2 years now. It seems like a while now. But I'm very happy to have him on here. I am joined by Greg Hahn. Greg, say hello, and I guess if you can give people like a quick bona fides of like who you are.
Thanks for having me, TL. I'm Greg Hahn. I'm a animation writer, comedy writer. I do some live action writing too. I'm working here in Los Angeles. I've written for shows like Sonic Boom, for Unikitty, for Lego Monkey Kid. There's a show coming out soon called Transformers Bot Bots that I wrote a couple episodes of. And so, you know, just working in the industry, trying to make things happen.
Yeah, no, and I think that's like one of the ways we linked up was I did a Laser Time episode a couple years back talking about cartoons, and we were talking specifically about video game cartoons, right? And this is like where the Sonic Boom thing comes up. And I remember, and I want to be completely honest, like it's so easy to come on here and be like, well, the success for Sonic Boom, everyone loved it. Everyone was like not into it, and I remember like being one of the people, like when I saw the original designs, just like, well, this isn't Sonic, right? Like everything everybody always says about Sonic, like this is Sonic. So like how, because I believe you and your co-writer Alan, like you guys were the showrunners of Sonic Boom, correct?
We were the story editors. Bill Freiberger was the showrunner, and okay, we were like the three of us were basically the staff together.
So how do you guys go into a project like that where you have such a, like you have such a, like an in, like an embedded, a fan base that has their specific Sonic, right? Like I'm like, we're older, right? So like my Sonic is the old Sonic, you know, the Jaleel White, that like, that's our Sonic. And then like people who are a little bit younger than us have like the Roger Craig Smith, like the original, like Sonic X Sonic. Like, so how do you go and be like, okay, we're going to make our stamp and do our own version of Sonic the Hedgehog?
Sure. Well, I mean, I will say I wasn't there at the inception of the Sonic Boom franchise. It was created. There was a game in the works. And then Evan Bailey, who was our producer on the show, had developed it. And he brought Bill in. Actually, I think the first couple episodes might have already been written in some form when Bill was brought in. And then Bill brought Alan and I into the project. So we weren't like, we didn't come up with the concept of it, but I think we honed the voice of those characters, and that's kind of what we brought to it. Bill's background is in TV sitcoms, right? He worked on Pee-wee's Playhouse, he worked on The Simpsons, he worked on Drawn Together. He worked in a space that leaned into comedy, and so when they brought him in as the showrunner, that was the natural direction for the Sonic Boom TV franchise. And when he brought Alan and I in, it was because that's the kind of stuff that we liked writing. You know, we were writing spec scripts of Curb Your Enthusiasm and It's Always Sunny and My Name is Earl and a lot of, you know, sitcom stuff. So Bill knew that we had similar sensibilities. And when he brought us into Sonic, you know, part of it was because Alan and I had actually grown up on Sonic. We had a Sega Genesis in those first couple of years. I played those first three games over and over and over again. So, you know, we had some Sonic knowledge, and we also had the same sensibilities as Bill from a comedy perspective. And that's how it all kind of turned into the thing it became.
Yeah. And it's like, I think the thing, especially like people who are our age, when you watch that show, what I always find funny, it's like everyone says like, oh wait, no, this is a show that understands the characters, right? And it's very true. Like you guys understand, like even if it's your slant of these characters, right? You still kind of understand the dynamic. And it is one of the like legitimate funny shows I've watched. Like even like, cause you'll get the stuff that gets memed and parodied, right? Like, like super woke Knuckles, right? Or you know, or like, you know, the Sonic fan. But it's just like, as just like the regular process, like the regular writing on it is just so good. And it's a testament to you guys, like of just being able to be funny and tell these stories with these characters like I said, that do have, like, no pun intended, a tail to them, right? Like, you can only do but so much when you try to work with those characters. If that makes any sense, what I'm saying.
I know what you're saying, and I first of all, thanks for enjoying the show. I appreciate it. I'm glad we have the fan base we do, and I'm glad that even a couple years after the show has been off the air, we're still getting messages about it. The fan base is real, and it's still there, and it's still rabid. But, you know, going back to what you said before, the different iterations of Sonic the Hedgehog, that's something that I get. You know, you always see, like, oh, a new version of this is coming out, and there's, like, this instinct from the pre-existing fan base to, like, say, no, don't do that. I want the one that I like, you know, but that's just not how things, first of all, that's not how things work. Certainly not in today's landscape. But if you look back at almost any franchise, if you look at, like, Batman, like, how many iterations of Batman are there? There's no one that's the right one. There might be one that's your favorite one, but it doesn't negate the existence of the others. You know, there's the Adam West Batman. There's the old comics. There's the 1990s cartoon show. There's Batman Brave and the Bold. It exists in all these different forms. So when Sonic Boom came around, yes, there are some changes to Sonic's design, to Knuckles's design, and to some of the characterization of those characters, Knuckles in particular, but that doesn't undo and unravel the Saturday Morning Adventures of Sonic the Hedgehog. It doesn't make Sonic Underground not exist anymore, and it doesn't take Sonic it doesn't erase Sonic X either,
right?
Or any of the video games. These can all exist side by side with each other and just be a different branch of the Sonic franchise, and that's what Sonic Boom is.
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting look at it. It's like, because I mean, that's the thing now, right? Is everyone is on taking a high horse. Like, I understand, like, you want to be, you know, very dismissive of living in a world of massive remakes and retellings, right?
Sure.
You know, but I also, like you said, I think when people kind of dig their heels in it, you kind of forget, like, most of storytelling is kind of retelling the same story, right? Like, what is every Adventure Quest but, you know, the Odyssey? Like, every story can, like, it's what you stamp on a story that makes it, you know, relevant and stuff. And, like, what you guys did with Sonic Boom, like, a thing that, like, honestly, I felt was, like, behind an eight ball because, like I said, there was such a visceral, like, we don't like this, and being able to create, like, these characters. And like I said, not just Sonic, but, like, the Eggman in Sonic Boom is one of my favorite Eggman. Cause it's just like, I am always been a big fan of, like, the dumb bad guy, like the bad guy who's evil, but not really. It's like, we could go, like, yeah, I'm going to go and do something bad, but then we could also, like, go have lunch later. Like, that kind of bad guy. That's why I love, you know, that Eggman. Especially, like, when we grew up, like, if you look at Saturday AM, like, as opposed to, like, Sonic and Hedgehog, like, their daily show, because, like, that's kind of more of, like, a Looney Tunes-esque thing. But, like, Saturday AM, which is, like, your more longer form, like, that's a very scary Robotnik, right? Yeah. Like, it's very, like, intimidating. So, like, I do love, like, being able to stamp and put your own taste of what a franchise is. And I think people need to kind of lessen their venom when that comes, because you don't know. It'll be somebody else's Sonic, right?
Exactly. And, you know, I mean, while you're talking about Eggman, I mean, he was our favorite character to write for. We loved the idea of this sad, like, attention starved Eggman. It wasn't just about he wanted to defeat Sonic. He wanted Sonic to pay attention to him as much as he thought about, he wanted Sonic to think about him as much as he thought about Sonic.
Right.
And so that was, like, kind of the driving force. And to be honest, Alan and I, and frankly, a lot of the freelance writers, like, probably pitched more Eggman stories than other stuff. And I remember in the beginning of season two, Alan and I submit a whole bunch of pitches, and we were told, like, okay, guys, less Eggman stories, though, maybe more Sonic focused stuff. So, you know, there was just, like, we were drawn to Eggman, the character, in particular. Because, yeah, I mean, he was so funny to write for, and Mike Pollack did such a great job, you know, vocalizing that character. I mean, all of our voice actors were really fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the, again, one of the stronger things is your guys' voice cast is tremendous. Like, I will always sing the phrases of Roger Craig Smith, who is just, who is so good. And like, and again, like we saw it with the movie, like with the movie casting, right? And this is not, I love Ben Schwartz. I want to say that. I think Ben Schwartz is a great voice actor.
Yeah,
as opposed to like, he's also a good actor, but he's very great voice actor. But like Roger Craig Smith, like for somebody, and again, he wasn't my original Sonic, but he just like, his Sonic is just, it's such a, like, especially like him doing more fun stuff as well as Sonic X, which is a, you know, it's an anime and you're trying to, you know, change your voice. Like your voice is a very anime like way, and you can be playful to a degree, but it's to the point. Like to kind of be more like a comedic foil to be a Bugs Bunny, I thought he did such a tremendous job in Boom.
Yeah, Roger's a rock star, and honestly, like I said, the whole cast really killed it. Colleen, you know, she understood when we were, you know, taking Tails, and when we were kind of like undercutting him, you know, we kind of made Tails the punching bag sometimes, but right. Colleen knew how to play with that. And Cindy is Amy. I mean, one thing I'm really proud of about Sonic Boom is Amy's characterization, because I think prior to Boom, Amy was just kind of this like pretty little character that had very little to her. She had a crush on Sonic, and that was like almost her entire characterization up until that point. And we got to really expand on that. And so, you know, Cindy Robinson, she got to kind of play on so many different emotions as Amy Rose.
Right. No. And as I actually wanted to get into that with that and Knuckles, right? Like, so like you said, Amy Rose, very, like you said, literally, if you look at the other games in Sonic X, she is just, there to be like, I love Sonic, and you guys kind of made her own character. And then how do you get to Himbo Knuckles? Because like, again, Knuckles is as a character, very like introduced, it's this Vegeta like, oh, I'm you know, I'm you, but I do it like a little bit, you know, grittier than Sonic. And then just going like, but what if we made him like just a himbo? And how do you get to that kind of like characterization for the character?
Well, like I said, we weren't there at the inception of this concept. And when we were brought onto the team, they were like, this is Knuckles, he's the dumb one. And I went, well, okay, if that's our job, that's what we'll do. And I'll be honest, like behind Eggman, Knuckles was the other character that was just like so much fun to write for, because he was, I don't know, he could be the butt of every joke. And, you know, just having a dumb character in the scene makes every scene that much easier to write. You can always throw in a dumb joke. I'd argue it's easy, but it's also super fun. Again, getting Knuckles to that point, that was a decision before we were brought on.
Right.
But, you know, I mean, once it happened, we just embraced it and we wrote it. And I think, again, it's not Knuckles of the games. It's not Knuckles of Sonic X. It's a very different characterization. But that's just the direction we went on this one. And I don't know. I think we got a lot of really great stuff out of that character.
Yeah, no, it's a tremendous show. Is it on HBO? I didn't look this. Is it on HBO Max?
I believe it is on Hulu.
It's on Hulu. Okay.
Yeah.
But please definitely go out and check it. It's a tremendous show. I also want to, you know, talk to you, like, I want to talk to you, Greg, about some of the other stuff that you've done. Unikitty, that show. So again, I don't know, like you do these shows, I'm just like, oh, I'm always impressed when I watch these shows. And it sounds awful when I say that. It's like, I'm always impressed, but you think that Unikitty, being this character who is a side character from this movie, and just like me, I'm just like, okay, well, you know, it'll be a you know, show, but like to be the show, like to have this kind of energy to it, you know, what is the thought process like when you guys are in the writing, when you guys are in the, you know, writing team working on something like that, like you're kind of building out like this, basically building out the smaller world, like this smaller part of this larger animated movie, and like making it its own world, making it its own thing.
Well, Alan and I, we were only brought on for a couple episodes. It was really a freelance job. We wrote two episodes in season three. One of them's a Sunken Treasure episode, and the other one is Unikitty and the Ice Pop Factory, which was basically like, Alan and I were like, let's write the Charlie and the Chocolate Factory episode, except at the end, it won't be satisfying that they got into the, you know, like, that episode in particular is just all the lead up where they're trying to find the golden ticket, they get it, and then we go to the factory, and it's just like horrible slush that they're, you know, forcing out of these machines, and it's just this horribly disappointing thing. But Unikitty as a character and as a show, I mean, they spun off an entire different universe off of the Lego Movie universe and created this like magical world and really got to expand on the Unikitty character, where, you know, it was all there in that movie, I think.
Right.
Now she's the leader of her team. What does that look like? And it was really fun to play around with, and it's such like she lives in this like magical candy cane kind of place where everybody's just like adorable and sweet. And she, of course, has that duality where on one side of her, she's this adorable, sweet thing. And on the other side, she can just snap at a moment's notice and they love like hardcore metal music. And right. You know, it was a really rich sandbox to play around in. And so, I mean, we had a blast working on that.
Do you find that's kind of easier, like with a preset sandbox, or like making, like, you know, kind of, is it easier like getting in something where it's like kind of preset, or being able to like build your own and play in your own sandbox, you know?
Is it easier? I think anybody would lie. They'd be lying to you if they said that it was easier to make your own world, because it's not. I mean, I have to write. You know, I write scripts, I get on a show. I mean, there's a learning curve when you've entered into someone else's pre-existing universe, when you join a show that already exists, when you have to write the episode, you have to watch a number of episodes, you have to learn who the characters are, you want to make sure you get those voices right. But creating something from scratch is a much harder task. And, you know, writing an original pilot is way harder than writing a spec of a pre-existing thing, I think. I struggle with it sometimes because it's just like, it's a lot more work. It's more than just, you don't just sit down with a final draft file and open it up and write interior magical kingdom day and just start writing. You don't, you need to figure out what is the world, who are the characters, how do they interact with each other, and what is the first story you want to tell? So, right. I mean, it's definitely a challenge to create something original compared to jumping in and writing a script of something else. And of course the challenge there is, can you nail the voices? Can you write it in the voice of that show? And that just takes practice, and that takes, you know, talking to the people in charge and further understanding.
Yeah, no. And I think you really hit the head on it. Like, as people, like, we're both creatives, right? And like having to, when you sit down and you're trying to create something and you're just like, oh, this is a great idea. And then, like you said, it's like, okay, now how do you formulate it? How do these characters, you know, work together? Like, you're telling this one story, and if you're creating something, like, you're telling this one story, but how does it connect? Or are you doing something different? Like, I absolutely agree with you. Like, I think I was telling my podcast partner, Sonia Ballantyne, like, favorite thing I've ever written was, like, I wrote a spec for why am I blanking on the name of that show? The Good Place. Mm-hmm. I wrote a spec for The Good Place because Jason Mendoza, you know, is from Jacksonville, Filipino dude from Jacksonville. Like, I know so many people. Like, so it, like you said, like, when you kind of have like that basis of like, hey, I kind of know what these characters are, it's so much easier to be like, oh, da, 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 da. But like building something is just like, but it's satisfying though, right? Like,
it's,
when you build something
satisfying
from your own, and you see it, and it's your voice, and you see your voice replicated, it's satisfying to be like, oh wait, I did that, and this is something that I created and made and it brought out there.
100%. Yeah, it's definitely, it's fulfilling to see when you've started from scratch and turned it into something else. But like I said, it's a lot harder. Mm-hmm. But you know, it's part of what you have to do, especially when you're working in this industry. People want to read your samples, and I think it used to be a thing, kind of even before I got into the business where like specs were the thing that people were reading, and now not so much anymore. Now everybody wants to read originals. So you've got to put in like a lot more work up front.
I wanted to talk to you for a good bit about the disparity in pay with writers for television writers and animation writers.
Yeah.
So again, like full disclosure, I know a lot of people animation industry, right? Like a lot of my friends are storyboarders and writers. So this is something that I feel very passionate about, especially like I love cartoons, right? And and I think I started seeing you tweet about this. I know like there's been fights forever, but you guys were tweeting about this. I want to say is October. Am I getting that time frame right?
Was like no, October, this was in November, December.
November, December. Okay. Yeah. And so yeah, like for someone who doesn't know, who like what kind of discrepancy are you guys seeing in pay between yourselves and you know, television writers without like getting obviously super nitty gritty, sure. Because it seems like it's just such a large divide and it's frankly unfair, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, for those unaware, currently the Animation Guild is in negotiations with the AMPTP, which is the producers union. And so we're in negotiations. It happens every few years and it's not just the writers that are currently looking for more. It's everybody in the animation world. But, you know, the writers in particular, that's where I come in. That's the stuff that I'm paying attention to most. The truth is, when you look at what we get paid compared to somebody who writes for live action, it's a fraction of it. It's I don't have exact numbers in front of me, so I don't want to say what, but like it's like a third at best of what they get paid for the same amount of work for like one page of writing of animation versus one page of writing live action. We get, you know, like 26% to 40% or something. I don't even take my numbers as accurate, but it's a sizable difference. And the truth is a lot of that is just because we're in a different union than they are. And so negotiations happen very differently. And one, you know, the WGA has a lot more power than the Animation Guild, but maybe that's not true right now. Maybe right now, I think what happened, the reason that I think people are so revved up about this at the moment, on top of the fact that it's negotiations time, is that over the course of COVID, Hollywood shut down. In large part shut down. It certainly slowed down dramatically. Live action, they had to cancel shoots, TV shows, movies, they were postponed. Animation might've gotten slowed a little bit, but we were still going. That's kind of something that I think everybody latched onto and said, oh, we are very valuable here. And going back to the writing fees, it's like, we're doing the same amount of work. It's not harder to write for live action than animation. Some people want to point at, you know, The Sopranos versus, you know, Sonic Boom or whatever. And it's like, we're not just talking about that. We're talking about Sonic Boom versus an iCarly versus, you know, like literally like live action still for children.
Right.
Paid significantly more than animation. There's something broken in the system here and it needs to be fixed. And some of it, you know, might not be able to be fixed. There's problems with, you know, residuals is not something that we get on the animation side of things that gets paid into our union and it helps distribute to our healthcare. And that's great, but it's not the same. And it's just like jarring when I talk to a friend who specializes in live action work, how much more money they make for the same amount of work that I do.
Right.
And it also, as a result of it, there's kind of this general, there's this general attitude that like maybe writing for animation is lesser because of that. That makes us lower on the totem pole of desirability only because of the parameters that were set up years ago that we had nothing to do with, that resulted in us getting paid less. And if there was less of a gap between us, I don't think it would quite be that way. So we just, you know, we're hoping that coming out of these negotiations, animation writers can get a fair wage and start to close the gap and, you know, be considered writers, because that's what we are. That's what we do.
Yeah. I just think of like, because you're absolutely right. I wonder if it's just a bigger issue when it comes to media. When it comes to like animation, right? Like, because the biggest thing where, like, when, as a fan, like when I was looking back, like I'm a huge fan of voice actors, right? Mm-hmm. And that would be the thing that would always like get in my craw. Because like you see actors, oh, well, voice acting, I could just put on my pajamas and voice. It's like, well, no, like you could, but like good voice actors are really good voice actors, right?
Yes.
And good animation writers are good animation writers. And it seems so weird to me. And I wonder if that's just like, everyone looks at stuff like you, if you look at like the history of animation, you look at like Hanna-Barbera and stuff, and still stuff, really well-written stuff, right? But storyboard driven, like maybe not as like script following, because you're trying to do like, almost like do like you're doing radio plays, but they're animated. And people think like, oh, well, that's easier to do. But like you said, like being able to write that format, being able to tell those jokes, it is just like doing like a live action show. And to do it well, you're asking a lot for not to pay people the right amount for that. It just seems very frustrating.
Yeah, it is. And when you do the math on like how much work as an animation writer you need to get in order to, I don't know, call it a career, to live.
Right.
It's an absurd amount, especially because this is a increasingly more freelance industry too.
Mm.
You know, it used to be that they would hire staffs, and nowadays they go like, well, let's just hire a bunch of writers. We'll talk in a room for a day or two or three, kind of, you know, figure out what's happening this season. And then they're not employed anymore. We will just pay them per script on a freelance basis. And so suddenly you need to accumulate like 10 plus scripts a year in order to just cover rent or, you know, and it's really like, it's a system that is falling apart, and there are fewer and fewer writers who actually see it as a viable career path because of that.
Do you think that, like, I hate getting doom and gloomy about it, but sure, do you think like without a significant change, are we probably going to see like the demise of like a animation writing team, like animation, like writers in general, right? Like I think of my buddy Charlie Gavin, who's done both, right? He's done storyboarding and he's, you know, he's done actual animation writing.
Mm-hmm.
But like you said, like this is a guy who has to do both. Like he's not like one field, because like just how animation pays. Like, do you think like if we are to stay in the trajectory that we're in now, it is feasible to have as many shows, especially now that we have so many services that need original content? And
yeah,
the thing is, this pandemic is not going anywhere anytime soon. So animation is probably the best place to put it. But then at the same time, like, you know, you don't want to, you want to make sure people are getting paid, right?
Yeah. I mean, again, the tricky thing is like how many people can live off of this? And I think that gap is shrinking. You know, there are mm-hmm. more and more people who want to work in it. And to some extent, there's more shows and that would mean more jobs, but it really just means like more freelance jobs. And it just means that like there are more and more people fighting for fewer and fewer opportunities, because the only people who are really making a significant living off of this are the people who are running shows, or the people who are friends of those who are running shows and can get significant number of freelance scripts. And as long as the industry keeps kind of shying away from actually either paying decent wages or employing people full time, yeah, it's just going to mean that being an animation writer is just like it's a tall order to expect that's a career path that seems viable. I mean, it already is difficult. Obviously there's a lot of competition. There's a lot of people who want to be involved in this kind of career path, but it's becoming harder and harder to, to stay in it and to continue doing it when the studios don't want to pay. I mean, this is a problem that's really beyond just animation, right? We're seeing right. it across every industry. People want to get paid a fair living wage, and there's dudes and ladies at the top just kind of hoarding all the wealth, dragons on their piles of gold. And we need to pry some of that,
just away some from of that. It down,
just a little bit, just a little bit. Yeah,
yeah. Like, and like I said, we're not going to say too doom and gloomy. It sucks because, like I said, animation was my first love. I tell people all the time, like, I love cartoons. When I was young, like, I played video games and stuff, and I worked in game stuff.
Sure,
but like, when I was a kid, that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to write like Dexter's Lab or stuff like that.
Oh, yeah.
So like, I've always loved animation, but like you said, it was just never viable for me. Like, I was just like, I would be like, I couldn't do it. And I think you also miss out on talent doing that too. Like, how do you know, like, there's not somebody who is going to write the next big cartoon that's gonna, like, the next Simpsons, right? Like, there's a Matt Groening out there who just can't afford to do that because of where the wages are. I don't know. It's always weird, but I don't want to stay super negative on that, but I absolutely hope that. So, Greg, I want to ask you just a couple rapid fire questions.
Sure.
That I haven't prepared to, I haven't told you. So okay. These are off top of the head.
All right, let's do it.
All right, growing up,
yeah.
Favorite cartoon?
Wow, that's a really hard question. I was absorbing so much television as a kid. If I had to just say one, I would just say The Simpsons. It's the easiest answer and maybe a cop-out answer. But The Simpsons was on, you could watch it several hours a day. In reruns, and it was one of the funniest shows. It was appointment viewing for me with new episodes. I would sit down, I'd watch it with my dad and my brother, and I had to see the next episode. So I guess The Simpsons. I mean, I was watching everything though. I was watching Batman, right. I was watching Freakazoid. I was watching the weird cartoons that came on at 6 a.m. where you're like, what was that? I love TV so much, and I watched so much of it, and I still do.
Yeah, no, I think Simpsons, especially like as writers, right? Simpsons yeah. it taught a generation how to be funny in yeah, animation. 100%. Like, because it's
not
like
just in animation,
but not just like, in animation,
it
was, right? Just
it revitalized TV comedies. In
yeah,
a way
it's,
that, yeah.
Yeah. Because me and my roommate, like, I will start watching it and I'll just get through like episodes. I get through seasons like 3 through 6 or 3 through 7, and I'm just like, yeah, there's nothing funnier than this. Like, there's just like,
yeah,
it's so good. It's like, oh, I just remember all this stuff. If you had a dream project that's not The Simpsons, right? Like, go back in time. You're like, hey, Greg, you get to work on this thing. What would it be? What would your dream
project? A dream project of the past, you're saying.
Yes.
Something that
yes.
has happened. Let's see. That's a great question. If I had to pick, I would, I'll throw this one out there. I really wanted to write, like, I wrote some specs for it. I would have loved to work on Regular Show. That show was like so up my alley as far as like the comedy sensibilities and the way that it heightened from something that was pretty grounded and by the end spiraled out of control.
Right.
And again, all of the like 80s and 90s references very much, you know, we're the same generation. I'm the same generation as JG Quintel. So, yeah, Regular Show's a show that I like would have killed to work on.
All right. And then last question, and I'm asking this because I know you and I know the people, I know the person I podcast with, favorite wrestler.
Oh, my
favorite wrestler.
My favorite wrestler. The answer has become very clear recently, although it's been, I think I've known it for a while. It's Bryan Danielson.
He's fucking best.
He's the greatest wrestler to ever live. He can do it all. He's like in the ring, on the mic, just, and you know, and you never hear anyone say a bad thing about him as a human being either.
Yeah.
He is just absolutely awesome. And he's been so good for so long. Even before he ever came to WWE, I was attending Ring of Honor shows back on the East Coast, and he was main eventing and looking like a star way back when. And he's so, so good. And he's still doing it.
I remember the first time. So like, I would always get those, like, you know, those magazines they'd have like the grocery stores, like those PWIs and stuff. Mm-hmm,
sure.
And they would always do like the end of the year. And I was a big wrestling fan. I've always been a big wrestling fan. And I would look through them, and on the back, they would do like the top 10 wrestlers of the month or the year. Mm-hmm. And every year, like, you'd have John Cena, you'd have TNA, they'd have AJ Styles. So you'd have all this stuff. And then every year it would say Bryan Danielson. I was like, I don't know who it was. And I remember it was like around 2010, and I was working in an office job, and I'm just like on Wrestling Inc. And I see like WWE signs Bryan Danielson and Nigel McGuinness, because they had both got signed at the same time. And then obviously Nigel got hurt.
Yeah.
So I was just like, okay, I've been hearing about this guy. I'm going to watch it. So like, Ring of Honor used to have these DVDs. It would be like the 4-hour compilation deal DVDs.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it was his first title run. And I will never forget, it was the match he had with Colt Cabana, the second one. So the first one, he has a Colt Cabana. Colt Cabana is doing this whole feud with Homicide. Mm-hmm. And then he beats Colt Cabana in like 40 seconds. And then they have this next match in Chicago. And it's an hour-long barn burner. And I'm just like, wait, who is this guy? And just fell in love with him. Like 100% co-sign. I love Bryan Danielson. I love Bryan Danielson. He's one of the best wrestlers.
He really is. He's the best. And he always somehow still surprises, even though you know how good he is. You still watch him and go, damn, this guy's really good.
Greg, thank you so much. I could chat up with you all day, but I'm not going to hold you on too long. Is there anything that you would like to promote? Your Twitter, anything like that?
Sure. Follow me on Twitter at It's Greg Hahn. If you like toys and action figures, that's all I ever post on my Instagram at It's Greg's Toys. Check out Transformers BotBots. I don't have a date yet, but it will be landing on Netflix sometime this year. I'm hoping it'll be in the first half of 2022, but I don't really even know. But Alan and I wrote a couple episodes of that I'm really excited for. It's like the first ever real Transformers comedy series, and it's going to be great. And also, you know, pay attention to social media, pay attention to the hashtag New Deal for Animation and Pay Animation Writers. There's going to be a lot more stuff showing up soon. So, you know, keep your ear to the ground and watch us try to fight for more money.
Yep. Yeah. You guys, if, like I said, if this does resonate with you, please, 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 when you see those hashtags out there, retweet them. Interact with them. Let's get the word out there. These people do a tremendous job, and they should get paid for it. And I want to thank Greg so much for being the first guest on here. I knew I wanted to do this like interview type thing. I knew I wanted to have you on here because, like I said, we've been trying to do this for a minute. But it's been an absolute great time. So I really do appreciate you for that.
Yeah, thanks for having me, man.
Oh no. As always. And like I said, I've reached out to you. We've already talked about doing other stuff. We'll definitely reach out to Greg about some other stuff. But if you do like what I do, you can follow the show I do, which is Pool House Live. Live from the Pool House is a episode by episode show of The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. I do with my co-host, Sonya Ballantyne. You can follow me on Twitter at Turbo Bison. Don't. I'm just angry on Twitter. You don't have to follow me. That's what I tell people all the time. Thank you guys so much. Leave a like and subscribe, and thank you for having a conversation with me.